Age we live in, and this age, filled with percolation of many kinds, can hardly be explained simply by a superficial analysis. Why is the world like it is? It is because there are at least seven men who rule the world from the grave. One of them will now explain to us why it is that the world is what it is in an economic sense. The seven men who ruled the world from the grave we have discovered so far are Charles Darwin, and then Karl Marx, and then Julius Wellhausen. And ah, what a profound effect these men had with their ideas as they broke upon the world. Then came Sigmund Freud, who was the father of psychoanalysis, who really became the touchstone of the present sexual revolution. And then John Dewey, who was the father of American education for 50 years, introducing these ideas into the minds and hearts of millions upon millions of American young people and the young people of the whole world. But now, there is another sense in which we have to think of our world, and that is what the world is economically. Do you know that there is a man who stands behind the authorship of the economic system that runs the world today? And as a result, we face problems more profound than most people know. Everyone agrees that the economics of Western civilization is approaching a dark abyss. And why is that the case? Who is the man who stands behind it all? His name? John Maynard Keynes, a name that we should never forget. But we only owe it to ourselves, said the people of that day. The world after the turn of the 20th century was an optimistic place. The Industrial Revolution was coming on strong, promising an expanded measure of prosperity for the nations of the West. For the left, a fair degree of percolation was promised by the widening dissemination and impact of Marxist theory. For the right, the expansion of capital, with its promise of wider industrialization, seemed to be a good omen for the future. By 1910, the first airplane was flown above the beaches at Kitty Hawk. The first automobile was to belch and wheeze its way down a narrow street in one of America's cities. The railroad system had been expanded to unforeseen dimensions, reaching from coast to coast with its promise to unify a young, robust nation called America. As we have seen, religious liberalism had taken hold in Europe and was beginning to penetrate the religious and academic worlds in the United States. It too brought with it a form of optimism, promising that it would deliver the culture and the churches from the narrow, legalistic views of the past and bring them into a wider, more opportune future. Behind it all, Darwin's writings, with their promise of the upward evolution of culture, were being read and believed. Even the American educational system, under the leadership of John Dewey of Columbia University, was percolating with new ideas attached to terms such as instrumentalism and radical empiricism. A sunny disposition prevailed in the first 10 years of this century and brought with it a measure of happiness and a sanguine attitude about the days to come. Time Life Books calls it the beginning of this fabulous century, and it gave the chapter about the first 10 years of this period the title The Cocksure Era. What they said was, it was a splendid time, a wonderful country. Most Americans felt that way as they welcomed the 20th century, and many of them said so with great animation and grandiose references to peace, prosperity, and progress. From Senator Chauncey Depew of New York, there is not a man here who does not feel 400% bigger in 1900 than he did in 1896. Bigger intellectually, bigger hopefully, bigger patriotically. Depew's colleague, Mark Hanna of Ohio, said, "Furnaces are glowing, spindles are singing their song. Happiness comes to us with all prosperity." The Reverend Newell Dwight Hills of Brooklyn said, "Laws are becoming more just, rulers humane, music is becoming sweeter, and the books wiser." Well, Time Life Books continues and says, "These statements set the mood for the first decade of the new century, and one for the period period several titles, The Age of Optimism, The Age of Confidence, The Age of Innocence, but another tag might have seemed appropriate to an objective visitor from abroad, the Cocksure Era, for this was a time when Americans were optimistic and self-confident to an extreme. They did not merely hope for the best, they fully expected it. Most people automatically assumed that all problems would be solved in the normal course of events. Meanwhile, the important thing was for a man to get ahead, to earn maximum returns from bountiful opportunities. Such was the attitude at the turn of the century and into 1910, 1912, 1914. But then, of course, something began to happen. There was a smashing blow that came upon the culture of the West, and that smashing blow came in the form of World War I. It started in Europe, but it soon moved out to embrace the civilized nations of the world. That war was fought over those years at the close of the teen years of this century, and when it was finished, the world reeled back in astonishment, and they began to evaluate what had happened in the world, and they said, this kind of devastation never could be expected. This kind of thing was absolutely foreign to the thinking of the optimistic people of America and of the world who looked for better days. Well, at the close of World War II, they said, well, we have learned a great lesson. We have saved the world for democracy. Mankind has made its last great mistake. And then people set to work on doing something new for the future. Liberalism had so influenced the ideas of American religion that then in the churches following World War II, they began to recite things such as, every day and in every way, we are getting better and better. We've learned the lesson out of World War I that man must not operate the way he does. We promise, therefore, a new and optimistic future. But they also began to talk about economics. Economics, of course, was on the optimistic side through the 1920s. The stock market was going up and up and up and up, and it seemed like millions could be made for nothing except betting on the optimistic side of the growth of the American economy. All of this was a part of the euphoria of the 1920s. People did not notice that the ideas of the liberals were moving in, but there was a man who did, and I would recommend his writings. His name was Gresham Machen, one of the great scholars of this century. He wrote a book in 1924 called Christianity and Liberalism, and he pointed to the horrible problems of the future that would surely come upon mankind if they pursued the course on which they had embarked at that time. Well, they did pursue that course, and that consequence is well known. In 1929 came one of the most devastating financial blows that any nation up until that time had ever sustained. It came in the form of the Great Depression, and the Great Depression made the fortunes of men and the fortunes of this nation appear to dissolve before our very eyes. And people began to think, what have we believed about America and the world and everything, including religion, but especially, what do we believe about economics, and what are dollars, and what are values, and what is stock worth, and how shall we understand all of this? The economic system of that day, especially in the element of unemployment, was a paradox. There was a great need for further production, and yet the need existed next to millions who were vainly seeking employment. The economic system of that day was a mystery of mysteries, and no one had the formula for solving it. Now let's think about what happened from there. Then came a man with a solution. He offered a new way of thinking about economics that was startlingly different, but when explained, seemed very plausible. Along with this, he appeared to have the personal credentials, the knowledge, and the world awareness that lent gravity to his economic views. He had already made a personal fortune in world finance and was one of Britain's most respected and avant-garde intellectuals. He was chairman of a life insurance company, but an intellectual of the first order. He appeared on the scene with what seemed to be the only workable solution to the economic problems of that day. His name was John Maynard Keynes. The solution he proposed and the sense in which he continues to rule the world from the grave can be summed up in the words Keynesian economics. Keynesian economics changed the face of the world, and it affects to this very day every living person on earth. Who was this man, this world changer? Well, Keynes was a well-bred English-born gentleman, born in 1883, the year of Karl Marx's death, by the way. In the early years of his education, Keynes demonstrated himself to be intellectually brilliant and convincing, a communicative salesman of his ideas to his schoolmates. By the age of 14, he had won a scholarship to Eton, and probably the most sophisticated boys' school in Britain at that time. He had great success as a student there and then went to King's College at Cambridge. There, Keynes again showed his brilliance and demonstrated himself to be a winning debater and a thoroughly capable individual at every other form of interaction with his professors and his peers. He so impressed his professors that they asked him to consider becoming a full-time economist. But though the door was open to him to pursue an academic career, he had little money at that time and replied that he wanted instead to manage a railway or organize a trust. Temporarily, however, he went into civil service for the British government, passing his tests with brilliance, though, interestingly enough, his lowest mark was in economics in that section of his education. Well, in 1907, he found himself in India representing the British government. Then came World War I, and Keynes was called home to work in the treasury of the British Empire. Very soon, as we may guess, he became an important figure in the treasury. Many thought that he contributed more in his post to the winning of the war than any other person in civilian life. Well, his reputation as an economist grew from there, so that by the time we came to the 1919 peace conference, he had a significant part in organizing the peace, particularly with reference to world economics. But he wrote about the conference. It was one of his lessons in life. He said the Council of Four paid no attention to these issues, that is, of the resuscitation of Europe, being preoccupied with others. Clemenceau to crush the economic life of his enemy, Lloyd George to do a deal and bring home something that would pass muster for the week, the president to do nothing that was not just and right. It is an extraordinary fact that the fundamental problems of a Europe starving and disintegrating before their eyes was the one question in which it was impossible to arouse the interest of the four. Reparation was their main excursion into the economic field, and they settled it as a problem of theology, of politics, of electoral chicanery. From every point of view except that of economic future of the states whose destiny they were handling. So he became critical of the economic ideas of those days, but this simply added to his reputation as a thinker. Well, he continued to emerge, but after the Depression of 1929 came the real questions about what to do concerning the economic future of Earth. The world was moving into a terrible depression. How shall we come out of this? Well, at that time, Keynes came to the United States. He had the opportunity of a most interesting interaction with the then Roosevelt administration in the United States. There was a great concern as to how to get it all going. America was disillusioned. The bright promise at the beginning of this century had begun to fade very fast. Long bread lines and people who were broke and out of work and many suicides centered around the loss of fortunes. What to do? This was when Keynes broke upon the American scene. Keynes had a set of theories that the world was beginning to pay attention to. They were expressed in his book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. This complicated treatise makes demanding reading, but it actually presents but a few pointed thoughts, and Hellbroner, one of Keynes's biographers, deals with this. He says, first, it includes an economy in depression should stay there. There was nothing inherent in the economic mechanism situation to pull it out. One could have equilibrium with unemployment, even massive unemployment. Keynes' book is very complicated reading, and I would not press upon you the involved quotes that one might come up with from this book. But what he advocated was the doctrine It was the responsibility of government to borrow money to create full employment and therefore produce prosperity at a given time of need in any nation. Keynes said that the purpose of government was to be the financial broker of the lives of people, and that government could turn on or off the faucet that would make for economic prosperity for everyone. In effect, what Keynesian therefore taught was, the government is God. The government is the ultimate source of financial reality, and for that matter, every other kind of reality as well. He taught that the government was the fountainhead that could make it all come to pass. The idea that government can do it all was the unspoken concept behind Keynesian economics. That assumption allowed Keynes to produce immediately satisfying short-term solutions. Someone is reported to have asked Keynes, yes, this appears to work in the short term, but what about the long-term consequences? Keynes's famous answer was, in the long term, we are all dead. In response to the Keynesian view, many voices have been lifted that ask the question, where does all the money come from? From what source can we continue to borrow ad infinitum the money that is needed in larger and larger amounts for the government to be the nurturer and the manager of everything? The answer, which came out of the Roosevelt administration in the 1930s, was deceptively simple. That is no problem, they said, because, of course, we owe it to ourselves. We owe it to ourselves. How about that? That answer, of course, was initially true. Government bonds were issued in the 1930s to finance the borrowing of the federal establishment. They were issued in the 1940s and called war bonds to finance the cost of the global conflict. Government bonds have been issued in greater and greater amounts since that time, and now it has come to the point where it's impossible to disguise the fact that the federal establishment in the United States is facing a most severe economic crisis due to its staggering debt. Once upon a time, the admission of a government deficit was a great embarrassment to the politician. Presidential candidates from both parties ran on the platform of promising to balance the budget and pay off the national debt. The claim even became a serious plank in political platforms and was sometimes actually believed by a gullible population. But there came a time when all of this changed. There was even perhaps a specific point of time in which it changed. In the middle of his administration, conservative Republican Richard Nixon made a surprising public confession. He said, "I am a Keynesian," meaning, of course, that he believed that it was the duty of the government to borrow money and create, of course, full employment out of its borrowing that would bring prosperity to the people. When we heard that statement, our hearts skipped a beat. But there it was. From that point on, no presidential candidate has seriously promised to reduce the debt, and most of them merely mumble about balancing the budget. In a kind of desperation, the Congress passed the Graham-Rudman Act, in which it was required that the deficit be reduced each year until finally government income would more than match expenditures and government obligation move down rather than up. The record is now clear that the Graham-Rudman Act was a chimerical promise. In fact, the government has even resorted to the ploy of disguising the true amount of the deficit by expropriating the Social Security fund gained from Social Security contributions and applying the money to the deficit. As a consequence, the average deficit now runs $100 billion larger than the stated figure.